Welcome to the Healing Grove Podcast. I'm Dr. Kristen Ryman, an integrative holistic family physician, author of Life After Lyme, and host in this virtual space of learning, healing, and growing. I believe humans are like trees, and our physical limb is only one of many. Health on all limbs of the tree, emotional, conceptual, social, spiritual, is absolutely required for the whole tree that is you to be vibrantly well. I created the Healing Grove Podcast as a place to showcase some of the world's best integrative and holistic medicine, to expose you to transformative tools and mindset shifts for all limbs of your tree. I hope you enjoy our conversation in the Healing Grove today as much as I enjoyed having it. Welcome to the Healing Grove Podcast. I'm so excited to introduce you to my friend today, Dr. Roger McPhillan. So I'll do my little intro and then we're going to let you talk about what it is you do and how you got to where you are. Does that sound good?
Sounds great.
All right. So guys, Dr. Roger McPhillan is a clinical psychologist. He's a writer, he's a speaker, and he's the host of a popular Radically Genuine podcast with Dr. McPhillan podcast, which last I checked was like in the top 1.5% of global downloads for podcasts, which is amazing. So good job there. It's also one of the few podcasts I listen to on a regular basis, and I encourage you to do the same. He's also an outspoken critic of the psychiatric diagnostic system in this country and beyond, and the prescription drug culture and harmful treatments that stem out of that. He is on a mission to bring awareness to the misrepresentation of science in healthcare and pop culture beliefs about mental health that undermine resilience and coping for us and our fellow humans. It's one of the reasons I love the podcast so much. He shares so much great wisdom and perspective and real science and evidence about the harms that some of these treatments do. He's board certified in behavioral and cognitive psychology by the American Board of Professional Psychology, and he's a diplomat of the Academy of Cognitive Therapy. He's been featured as an expert on popular podcasts and national media outlets, including the One America News Network, National Public Radio, Time Magazine, and the Relatable Podcast with Ali Beth Stuckey. Dr. McPhillan specializes in cognitive behavioral therapies for the treatment of post-traumatic stress, eating disorders, and those struggling with anxiety, mood, and chronic suicidal behaviors. So, and thank you for being here. So let's hear a little bit about you and, Roger, what put you on this path to where you are helping so many people kind of learn these important things and develop resilience?
Thank you, Kristen. I mean, it's an honor to be here. It's an honor to be here with all of you. I think I'm at an interesting age. I'm 47 years old, so I've been able to kind of observe and witness some decline in American culture. You know, I've gone through, like most of us probably can remember, before there was even an internet or before there was cell phones. And when I initially got into the mental health field, it was somewhat by accident. I had alternative kind of goals and dreams in my career. I was potentially considering going into education and was an education major undergrad. I was a college athlete and was interested in going and coaching. But my first exposure to the mental health field was right after undergrad. I worked at a local children's psychiatric hospital, which was ages 5 to 10. And it was my first exposure to just how we conceptualized, identified, and treated children in crisis. And the overwhelming majority of children in crisis in that hospital setting came from abusive backgrounds, clear post-traumatic reactions, and were acting out behaviorally in school and in the home that prompted them to be psychiatrically hospitalized. And, you know, what I witnessed during that time can only be, you know, identified as what I saw as abusive, multiple mood and mind altering psychiatric drugs that would often put kids into, just a prolonged state of just lethargic behavior, sleeping 16 to 18 hours a day. I saw horrific side effects. And it just led me at that point, I think I was 22 years old, where I really just started questioning the narrative. And it took me down a place in my career where I went for further education. I was in the school systems, the juvenile justice system. I received a master's degree, went into my doctoral training at Philadelphia College of Osteopathic Medicine, and was just really trying to understand, you know, within the scientific literature, how do we best help people who have been suffering and struggling? And additionally, I think I've just been well-read on some things historically, philosophically, and just trying to understand the plight of being a human being, you know, the challenges of what it means to be human and live this life. And what I've kind of witnessed is it's kind of a distortion over the years of kind of scientific findings in order to fit a specific narrative. And I had to resolve the conflict between, you know, what I was observing in clinical practice and what was happening right in front of me versus what the prevailing narrative was. And I think it took a lot of years for me to feel confident enough to kind of understand historically how drugs come to market, the inner workings of the FDA, the clinical trials around drugs, how the DSM, which is the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, was developed, and just a lot of conversations, critical conversations, and asking questions with medical professionals on their training. And it had to inform me, being on the front line of the healthcare system in mental health, is we began to see this rapid increase in self-injury, suicidal behavior, mood and anxiety conditions that are really well documented, you know, over the past 15 years or so. And so I had to really become well-informed to be able to articulate these messages to my clients and their families, especially around concepts of informed consent, because I was realizing that the consequences of taking these drugs or identifying with this mental illness diagnosis, you know, was creating much more harm than people it was helping. And many people in the medical professional were just kind of repeating the pharmaceutical sales line. And once COVID hit is when I decided I really needed to do something. Prior to COVID, I was providing our center with a position statement on antidepressants for children and adolescents, given the overwhelming data that they create harm, the black box warnings, and the challenges we were seeing. I felt it was necessary that we came out with a position statement. And then once COVID came, I started seeing very similar playbooks from the pharmaceutical companies and medical authorities and the media and how they are overvaluating a medical intervention and underestimating its risks. And that's when I started the Radically Genuine podcast, really to just start talking about mental health and providing information regarding these psychiatric drugs and alternative viewpoints. And I've started connecting with people globally, statisticians, researchers, academics, people in the field, and most importantly, a global community of harmed patients. And so it's part of my mission right now to be able to really communicate that message and allow people to make informed decisions. My social media has been a manner in which I've been able to communicate that rather directly to bring attention to, I think, what are important issues. And that's been really, that's helped grow the brand of Radically Genuine, which is just an being absolutely honest and trusting people can make the best decisions with their health. And as a psychologist, and Kristen well knows, you know, a lot of this comes down to, for me, it's kind of a return to common sense in a lot of areas, to kind of communicate and articulate the value of emotions and how to build really important skills to cope with the challenges that exist, to think about the complexity of our health and well-being and all the factors that can contribute to why someone might not be feeling well, especially lifestyle, nutrition, spiritual aspects. A number of things that I think are really important in order to be able to live well have been removed from the general conversation. And it's been limited to ideas of like a chemical imbalance in the brain that requires, you know, drugs to correct that supposed imbalance, even though there's no scientific evidence to support that. And, you know, just communicating in that manner has created great harm. So, you know, we try to do that work here at my center on the Radically Genuine podcast, and as well as myself going on a lot of other popular media outlets and having conversations like this, just to be able to answer some of those critical questions.
Awesome. So there's like 14,000 questions I have after that. I want to unpack maybe a handful of them. The first one is, I'm really just hearing that story reminds me of how much overlap we have in terms of kind of stepping outside the mainstream and really learning for ourselves based on literature that's available that a lot of people don't take the time to look at or don't think could possibly be there. If this is what we're actually doing, why could it be possible that there's literature that really demonstrates harm? And I wonder about, I wonder about the loneliness of this path for you. I was really lonely during COVID. I remember when I met you, I was like, oh my gosh, where have you been all my COVID? Because I felt like such a weirdo and so distant from my medical tribe and my colleagues. And I guess I wonder, have you had that similar experience where you just felt like, wow, I'm really kind of swimming upstream here?
I think I've felt that way for 15 years, to be honest with you. And that's why I've tried to surround myself with like-minded professionals at Center for Integrated Behavioral Health and really try to engage people in the conversations. And, you know, as far as one of the powerful impacts of social media was my ability to be able to connect with people around the country and around the globe who have been questioning the same narrative. And some people who've been more advanced actually in taking those steps and as far as like obtaining knowledge. And so I just learned from so many other people who've already done some of the work before me, who were able to direct me in really important, places within the literature. There's been, you know, books written about this for 30, 40 years. It's just, it has not really become a mainstream idea. I mean, that's really been shut out from, you know, the popular narrative and culture. And that's because of the impact of media. Because mm-hmm. the pharmaceutical companies in the United States are the main funders of most media. So those advertising dollars are so powerful. So it's very difficult to be able to get those message out and have those discussions. When I started a YouTube channel this past June, never started a YouTube channel before, I just opened it up with a 7-minute video reviewing the literature on antidepressants for children and adolescents. On the video, I would pop up the published article, citing the authors and then highlighting in the texts, you know, really important findings. Kept it at 7 minutes because that's usually about what the average attention span is on YouTube. So that was very deliberate. So easy to digest, but really supported by sound science. And the first day we had that up, they took down the entire account. So it was no warning. There was no strike. So even went through their policy, you know, and their policy really supports that if they believe there is something that is misinformation, that you at least have the ability to respond to it and to keep your account. And what happened is we were, completely taken down. Our account was terminated. Which was turned out to be a blessing in disguise because I just took that same video to Twitter and it ended up getting mass reposted, by people such as like Joe Rogan, for example, who has millions of followers. And so that brought attention to the issue of censorship and censorship of scientific findings outside of the narrative, which forced Google and YouTube to have to place our account back up. We've been heavily.
So you got your account reinstated.
We got it reinstated because there was such an outcry from the public. I mean, there's over 1 million views to that video on Twitter alone.
Wow.
So they actually responded. Joe Rogan spoke about it on his podcast. Some other popular podcasts spoke about it. So it was just an opportunity to bring attention to a really important issue, and they reinstated it. And so you can go to my YouTube, you can see that video. It's very clear about what the science states. Like a great example of this, and many people don't know this, is Prozac was approved for the treatment of depression and OCD in youth. Of the 15 trials that were conducted, 12 did not demonstrate any efficacy. So 12 of the 15 trials did not outperform placebo. 3 did, but they removed the most suicidal kids. So it's very clear that it was inducing suicidality in teens who were taking it. They removed them from the original data. I'm calling it emotional lability, and then reanalyzed the data. And then published those 3 that showed efficacy, as small as it is, to outperform the placebo group. Now, there's at least a double the risk of suicide, at least double. If we had to, you know, a real good look at the data and we're able to kind of examine what is actually happening in in clinical reality, a lot of us believe it's like at least a 4-time risk of suicide. So now by course, we are providing Prozac to kids who express depressed mood or self-injury. And we know that that at least doubles the risk, probably quadruples the risk. So it's things like that are really important for the general public to be able to make an informed decision. And so that got taken down off of YouTube. But that's the battle that we're in right now. Anything that's against the mainstream narrative is deemed misinformation and prone to censorship. So it really does require a community of people to be able to really stand up against that medical authority. And so just, you know, to answer your original question, I think I found it to be rarely lonely when I was not connected to how big this movement actually is. And when I was kind of doing it in isolation here at my center and trying to fight battles locally, once I began to realize there's a global community of harm patients and there's been people speaking out on this over the years, I've been able to join, I think, a group of professionals who have really been outspoken and courageous in being able to get to the public.
Awesome. And well, that was my next question. Like, as a, you know, it sounds like you have been sort of targeted, or at least your account was targeted because you were speaking truth to power that has a lot of money that doesn't want that message to be out. Were there any surprises based on the kind of outreach that the podcast has allowed for you, and any kind of like unexpected turnouts of supporters? Like, who else has shown up to kind of be in your corner that you weren't expecting?
Yeah, it's really interesting because I did not expect that we would be on the top 10 for Apple charts for mental health and like health and fitness. I did not believe we would have professors or people from Australia to Hong Kong to, you know, the UK throughout the world contacting, you know, me privately, kind of saying, continue doing this, continue speaking out. And so I think it's probably a 75% positive response, but I'll get 25% of people who are calling me a quack, who will get in my comments on Twitter or other social media, say I'm spreading misinformation, or, you know, call me names. You know, that's usually what happens when you have a hard time articulating an argument, is you just kind of discredit the individual. And the biggest one here is that, you know, I'm a psychologist and not a medical professional. So, you know, little do people know that psychologists conduct research. I've published research. I feel like I can read medical research and articulate the findings. I have a doctoral level knowledge of statistics and research design. And plus, I'm a mental health professional who's a clinician. So it wasn't too recently that I had a psychiatrist from Johns Hopkins speak out, make comments and repost some of my statements on social media, saying that I have no business making these comments. I have no medical training, and therefore I have no right to speak out on these issues. She basically denied that antidepressants created harm in children at all. She was a child and adolescent psychiatrist. And it's very easy to dispute that because, you know, even the FDA warns against it. You can go to the drug website, and due to their own need to be able to protect against litigation, it's very clear about the potential reactions to these drugs. And it's outlined clearly. It's just, you know, the hope is that the language, the word antidepressant, is powerful enough to, communicate to the general public that they have a drug that is actually antidepressant. So word language is powerful. The marketing has been powerful. It's been so powerful that it's really influenced the overwhelming majority of physicians who are writing the prescription drugs. And when you look into some of the research, now over 80% of the drugs are being prescribed in primary care settings. So pediatricians, the primary care doctors, and they're very limited in their understanding of diagnosis of mental health conditions. It's usually limited to the 15-minute meetings, if that they have, and being able to understand what might be going on in the complexity of a person's life. And they're just kind of reiterating the pharma marketing propaganda. So I think COVID has really helped in being able to have a kind of a global awakening about how information is presented to the public that doesn't really fit the science or our best well-being health-wise. And so that large global awakening has led for me to have a platform and have overwhelming support. The 25% that are usually responding negatively, some of them are, unfortunately, people have really bought into the narrative and have been on drugs for, you know, decades. And they misunderstand, you know, one of the things that's very common is someone might miss a dose of an antidepressant or another psychiatric drug, and they feel really horrible. And they think that's the return of their mental illness, or that would be their baseline if they weren't on drugs. And one of the key points of communication is that these drugs create dependence, and the withdrawal is serious, very, very serious. And the withdrawal is misunderstood as a returning mental illness. And one of the problem with putting young people, teenagers, young adults on these drugs is they're often missed doses. And it is the, when you're increasing a dose, starting or stopping a drug, is when the risk for akathisia, psychosis, mania, increased suicidality are at their greatest because of the impact that it has. And so it's so important that we're provided accurate information, because look at we're in a mental health crisis. You can just look at the data to support that. Unprecedented rates of completed suicide in populations that were traditionally not suicidal. It's been rare for children or teens to actually act out and die on suicide traditionally, historically. And we have every single year it's increasing. And it's increasing for multiple factors, but the way that most kids are going to die by suicide is overdose on the prescription medication that they're provided. And this is the things that I'm witnessing in clinical practice. You'll see a kid who might be struggling, and we all understand that struggle is part of life. It's very rare for us to go through an entire lifespan without experiencing episodes of really low or depressed mood or anxiety, or a lot of the problems that are now pathologized. We've medicalized every aspect of the human experience. So it's quite nefarious to try to medicalize that and say it's a disorder that needs to be drugged, because when kids go through, teens, young adults go through some of the expected trials and tribulations that would occur during this developmental period, it's now being pathologized and they're going on a drug. And so I'm seeing kids who were never suicidal previously become suicidal very quickly once they start on a regimen of drugs. And that's the information. I think it's one of the defining moments of our time is medical freedom and us being able to consent to any medical intervention and to be able to be informed of what those risks are. And as you know, as you well know, Kristen, I think being able to accurately identify what is going on with any person takes time and takes investigation. And we're so prone to just quick heuristics or labels that inaccurately define what a person might be going through. And unfortunately, I think that leads to like pretty significant misdiagnosis and harm in the medical system.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're right. There are so many factors at play here. And, you know, when I think about this, 80% of SSRIs or, you know, psychiatric medications coming from, you know, family doctors like me and GPs and internists, you know, and OBs maybe who I know what that schedule looks like. You know, that's like really an eight minute per patient dealio. And one of the things that you're supposed to do before you walk in the room is review all the notes the nurse has taken, which includes like the PHQ-9 or maybe even just the PHQ-2, like the mini version of like two questions that are supposed to like rule in or rule out depression. Like, come on. Except, you know, you can't just then walk into the office or walk into the room and be like, well, it looks like you're depressed. Here's a medication for you. But that happens. That does happen. And it's complete, you know, it's complete standard of care. And at the same time, it's total malpractice.
Yeah. The interesting thing about the PHQ-9, which we refuse to use at our practice, the PHQ-9 was developed by Pfizer. And if you read through the questions on the PHQ-9, the 9 questions, most of those questions, depending on how someone might answer it, has multiple reasons why they may experience it. So it has poor construct validity, meaning that you can screen out positive for depression and have no existence of depression at all. It's very, the questions are very poorly constructed. It's even worse for the adolescent version. So it's very confusing, and it creates very normal experiences and frames it as if it's a symptom of depression. So with that screening measure, you're going to over-identify the number of people who are actually depressed.
Yeah. And so overly sensitive and not very specific. And as a result, it gets a lot more people to buy Pfizer's products.
Exactly. Right. I mean, it's a brilliant marketing strategy. And for Pfizer, I mean, they are beholden to their shareholders. They're not really beholden to the health and well-being of the customer. So, you know, the one thing that I've been speaking about is that the more people who identify as mental illness, so, you know, there's a strong marketing component to this idea of decreasing stigma. And so decreasing stigma really is code word for let's increase the number of people who can self-identify with mental health problems like depression and anxiety so they can get the help that they need. The help that they need has become a psychiatric drug. It's become a prescription. And little, the public knows little about what actually, you know, the efficacy of that drug or the long-term harmful effects of those drugs. And so they're doing a great job of increasing customers and creating customers for life.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about just the prevalence of this and how social media has contributed, because I feel like there's there's just so much more awareness, but it's not always the right kind of awareness, right?
Yeah.
What's been your experience with that?
Yeah, this is another really concern that I've been outspoken about, and it's called the social contagion effect. And we saw this actually in the 90s. I have a background in the research treatment of eating disorders. In the 1990s, American television and magazines were promoting this thin ideal of American models, and they were putting them on covers of magazines and major television networks. And what ended up happening is that became kind of like a contagious effect in American culture, where we see this uptick in anorexia in teenage girls. And with the advent of the internet and social media, they were developing pro-ana websites and a communication of that as a lifestyle. And you can just see how it could almost become contagious. We're seeing the same thing with like mental illness with TikTok and YouTube, is that YouTube influencers and other influencers are self-identifying with a mental illness diagnosis that is curating some disability status or minority status in which they can be discriminated against, and they're building a brand around it. And the one thing you know about vulnerable teenagers is this time in development is an important and critical period for identity development. And so if you are feeling like you're on the outskirts, or you are not, you know, connected to anyone in your school or community, which became more prevalent during COVID, by being exposed to these TikTok videos, YouTube, some of these influencers, they began to self-identify themselves to be part of a community. And so we see, this is something, when I started the practice in 2012, I never saw this. Now it's quite prevalent for kids, teens, young adults to come in and self-identify. I'm ADHD, I'm autistic, I battle depression and anxiety. So they're self-diagnosing, and then they're presenting themselves with the limited understanding of the symptoms of the diagnosis that are easily obtained through social media or through Google searches. And it's almost they've played the part. And seeking out of the psychiatric drugs has been validation that they are struggling. And in a lot of ways, they are struggling. So I want to kind of state that they do feel lonely. They do feel disconnected. They are trying to determine, you know, where they fit in society. But it's very dangerous to use mental illness as that developing identity. And the viewpoint that is often portrayed is that this is lifelong. You know, I am mentally ill. I am depressed. I will be depressed the rest of my life. I require drugs to function. I'm not like anybody else. And I think you can just understand the dangers of that kind of viewpoint. Instead, traditionally, our own mental health struggles have been episodic. You know, something that occurs in response to challenges that exist in our life, and our emotions are really good indicators that we have to be able to maybe make some changes or face some challenges that exist. They're really there to serve us. So emotions have been vilified as symptoms of an illness, as part of the medical model. And this medicalization of our culture has led to a lot of young people misunderstanding and misrepresenting what they're actually feeling. Also leads to this social comparison that is really problematic. I can't tell you how many times I've heard in my office this prevailing idea that they are broken, that there is something within them that is, imbalanced. They're genetically inclined to not be able to perform or live like somebody else. And of course, that's constructed, right? That's an idea that is constructed in their own experience, influenced by popular culture. And I just think it's critical that we have to protect young people from these ideas. Some of these ideas are being reinforced in school systems by professionals who just don't have adequate knowledge. They're just kind of repeating the popular culture narrative.
So what would you say to someone who might be listening to this and is just like, well, how would you describe it then? Like, if you're not going to buy into these labels with me that are like my life support, they're my community, they're my brand, they're my identity, they're my hope for maybe feeling better, because with them comes along this promise of like a pill that might lessen the burden of this. Like, if you're going to take all that away from me, like, what do you got in return? Like, what else can I have?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think it always starts with kind of validating the emotional pain that somebody's in, because they'll defend against that because they feel invalidated. And I think we can validate the valid and at the same time be able to point out the harms of a certain way of coping. So we validate the emotions that they are struggling. The idea that there's a quick and easy fix to that is going to just take the person down a road that creates a lot of problems. We can shift the narrative in the manner in which they view their own experiences. Instead of being broken or their emotions are wrong or disordered or imbalanced, we can understand that their emotions in context fit some of the facts of what is going on around them. And any ideas that it is permanent flies in the face of any conventional wisdom or common sense or even any scientific evaluation. Our emotions are like the weather. They're constantly changing. And we use our emotions to benefit us. And there's an advantage to using our emotions. And so I really want to get somebody on board with being able to face the challenges that they're experiencing in a way that serves them and serves them well in the long run. The overwhelming amount of people who are suffering feel lonely, disconnected. Relationships are so important. We are relational beings. And so the overwhelming amount of times that provokes somebody to come in to seek out mental health treatment usually is some form of crisis relationally or within their work or with their identity or with a significant loss, right? And, we can even conceptualize depression as kind of a prolonged experience where the person is struggling to cope with what is happening. And professional intervention is important. I think it can help a lot of people. One of the ideas that tend to be rather common is somebody believes that their pain is never ending. And if you believe that your pain is never ending and there is nothing you can do about it, that is actually a recipe for self-injury and even suicide, because it just fuels hopelessness. And so I want to be able to really, motivate and support somebody in order to be able to develop skills and resiliency and to know that they can do something. They have some agency in their life. I also, believe that these difficult experiences and even a depressive episode can be a gift. And people think that sounds crazy when I communicate this to the general public. But if we all can sit back and look on our own lives, you'll probably look back at some point where your own challenges and the emotional pain that you experienced kind of, led you down a path in your life that was more aligned with probably what your greater purpose was, and that there is real value to learning when we are suffering. And if there is no value attached to suffering, if we suffer without and we struggle without any purpose or meaning attached to it, that's when there's an emptiness that's bred, and that's when there is a hopelessness that's bred. So it's, we have to be able to get people to see purpose and struggle. And that's why it's so much better to normalize it. If we normalized it in schools instead of pathologizing it, if we normalized it in our homes without pathologizing it, instead of rushing everybody to a doctor or a mental health expert to try to, out of fear based on any struggle that kind of arose, that we kind of created our environments and created our communities to both mentor and support that struggle with a keen eye and attention to, okay, what do we do now? What is next? Right? You're feeling this way, you're struggling here. What opportunities lie in front of us? And that would be a game changer. It'd be an absolute game changer. And instead, we're provoking fear. Parents are parenting in fear. Medical professionals, mental health professionals respond in fear. We are, we're putting too many kids in psychiatric hospitals because of fear of what they can possibly do, and not really understanding that the moment you go into the hospital, we are now decreasing the likelihood of having a positive outcome. We're actually putting them the path down the path of poor mental health treatment, which is identification with the diagnosis and putting on multiple drugs. And then again, reinforcing the idea that there is something broken within them that requires fixing. We require a radical shift, in my opinion, culturally, if we're going to be able to kind of transform what we're going through right now and transcend from a fear-based culture into one that's more based on love and compassion, and that science is rooted in that, not in some industrial collaboration, you know, for capitalism, which is ultimately it everything is kind of benefiting a sick care system in which we live in. And I don't see it rooted in compassion anymore. I see overworked physicians. I see overworked mental health professionals who are following these guidelines that are certainly influenced by industry and their role with major medical organizations and psychological organizations. And we've just kind of stepped away from being able to just be supportive and try to understand what someone's going through and letting them know we'll be there for them and they'll get through this. Instead, it's just really a fear-based culture that's created a crisis. And, you know, one of the things that's feeding the hospital-based systems in our region, you know, the mental health component, the psychiatric component of our hospital-based networks are growing dramatically. And they're going to be serving this crisis through this fast food mental health care approach, which is get them in, get them a drug, put them in front of somebody where we can provide this pseudo therapy, which is, you know, unfortunately, it's just kind of talking to a stranger with not a lot of direction or not a lot of purpose. And so it's a broken system and we have to make changes.
So what would the changes be? Like if you had your magic wand, if that like podcast microphone were like actually a magic wand you could wield, what would you do? What are like top three things that would shift the needle here?
The first one is I would completely eliminate the idea of DSM diagnoses as if they're medical, discrete medical conditions. So if that book just got burned today and was never used again, and instead we just understand how someone presented as representation of really important things that they have to address, we would do so much better medically and psychologically. I'll give a great example of this. Everyone knows that bipolar disorder, you know, exists. My argument is that mania exists, depressive illness exists. There's no such thing as bipolar disorder. Mania and depressed mood can have multiple reasons why they exist, including potentially related to circadian rhythms, to drug use, to environmental toxins, to a genetic vulnerability that's provoked under certain conditions. We label and identify bipolar as its own discrete illness, and then we prescribe mood stabilizing drugs that have increased the chronicity of the disorder, and we've taken something that's episodic and made it chronic. People don't realize that, you know, if you go back into the literature, back into the 1940s and 50s, 85% of a person who was experiencing mania, it was only one episode. And it was never another episode. So the idea that these are chronic illnesses have been created. Same thing with ADHD, same thing with the idea of major depressive disorder. We give these medical sounding labels to it as if they're discrete medical illnesses. You don't go in, you don't get a blood test for it. There's nothing we're observing. There's nothing medically we're observing. We're not providing an intervention in an empirical way and then measuring its progress. So we act as if they're medical disorders. We treat them as if they're medical disorders with pharmaceuticals, but it's pseudoscientific. There's no way we can measure it or identify it. In fact, its existence in our society has caused great harm. So I think that would be step one. Step two would be really trying to promote resiliency and understanding emotional literacy just throughout our communities, whether that's our school system, our medical professionals, our mental health professionals, podcasts, television. You know, if we were able to normalize struggle and then we responded in ways that helped people overcome them, develop the necessary coping skills, it transcends, you know, the crisis that currently exists. And I think the third point is that, you know, we have to really take a look at our lifestyles and our health. So what changed post 2007? You know, like if we look and we see these dramatic rise in identification with people struggling emotionally, and there's good data that suggests this is unprecedented. Like, just generally speaking, in American culture, people are talking about just generally feeling unwell, right? We might get labeled as depression or anxiety, but they're just feeling unwell. Well, what is contributing to that, right? Can we look at our dependence on smartphones, social media exposure, lack of exercise, movement, being socially disconnected in the manner we're socially disconnected? What are we putting into our bodies? It's interesting, like the more you go into looking at a lot of the literature on nutritional deficiencies and how that may react, how it might manifest itself, they're going to manifest itself in terms of what could be identified as a psychiatric illness, whether that is low mood, chronic fatigue, sleep problems, anxiety, agitation. Look at our sleep patterns. You know, there's so many factors, environmental toxicity, you know, that exists. Looking more deeply into vaccines, we're going to have to identify why there's been a 27,000% increase in a diagnosis of autism, right? And you're going to, what's going to be implicated in that is the widespread use of pharmaceuticals and potentially like vaccinations and how we are responding in our allopathic medical environment. And so those are three core, you know, areas that the label and the diagnosis that we use and its impact, our poor coping and our lifestyles. You know, those things are absolutely necessary to address. And I don't know any mental health professional who is able to adequately help somebody without understanding the complexity of everything that might influence why someone isn't feeling well. So you have someone who just comes in and you're not even evaluating those factors, sleep, exercise, social connection, smartphone dependence. One of the things I ask my clients, pull out your phone. Let's take a look. What is your average time in that screen? So when I have young people and even adults our age, or my age at least, you know, middle-aged people, and they're on that phone 9-10 hours a day, how do you feel well? How do you feel well when you are absorbed in that reality? I know when I spend a couple hours on my phone, I get a headache, I'm dizzy, my emotions are certainly not as stable as they otherwise could be. I could be easily provoked by social media. Even right before I came on this podcast, and I'm trying to do more social media just for this message, I commented on Instagram, I think for the first time, and it was a professional who was relating specific neurochemicals to athletic performance. And I'm against biological reductionism. So the idea of saying serotonin or dopamine are going to be related to this behavior. And so she was like tying serotonin to Kobe Bryant. And a number of things. And I just had to respond, you know, about how dangerous this type of rhetoric is, because it feeds into the narrative that very simple neurochemicals or brain chemicals are the source of any type of behavior or action. You know, someone's sports performance is so complex, obviously. Their physical gifts, their hard work, their mental acuity. There's so many factors. And so what's happened is we've really dumbed down our understanding of what it means to live well. And that gets promoted on social media.
Yeah. Yeah. So true. You know, everyone's kind of the magic bullet or the single pill or the one answer. And so actually I might even be about to ask you for one answer, because as I think about those three things, I feel like the first thing is not inside my control. The third thing, I mean, I could burn my own DSM, I guess I could do that. I'm not sure I even have one anymore. The third thing, I'm totally dialed in. You know, I'm absolutely, my mission is also to help raise elevate the awareness rather about lifestyle importance and food and the importance of non-toxic living and all those things and how they in community, right? All the things we do in the Healing Grove, how those contribute to health and well-being. The resilience piece, I think, actually results from number three. But one of the things that I felt so strongly when I took your course, Roger, was, wow, if our government, rather than cutting everyone a check for some measly amount of money that didn't go very far, if they'd actually just paid for a program like this for everyone, what a different world we would be living in. If people were replacing their fear and learning how to cope with their uncertainty with something like DBT. So I'm wondering if you would give us like a little synopsis of what DBT is, and then maybe like your favorite tool that you think if everyone knew this one thing, we might actually make a difference.
Sure. Dialectical behavior therapy is a form of cognitive behavioral therapy that melds Eastern philosophies around mindfulness and acceptance with Western mainstream psychology around behaviorism. So in behaviorism, like very simply is that if we can change our behavior, we can change the way we think, we can change the way we feel, and environmental contingencies are major factors in maintaining behavior. So if we can understand that if we're going to get people to change, we have to get focused on them living differently and changing that the way that they cope and the way that they react. Dialectical is a philosophy that you can synthesize multiple truths to exist at the same time. It's usually looking at extremes. We're in a very extremist based culture where we tend to make things all or nothing. And the idea of dialectical philosophy has wide influence in being able to improve communication, the way we think about problems and solve problems. But the one of the major influences of this Eastern cultures around mindfulness and acceptance, I think, are powerful. And they're also really important in how we cope with emotional pain and emotional distress. So in dialectical behavior therapy, you're synthesizing two extremes, change strategies and acceptance-based strategies. And the more that we can cultivate a mindful attention to the moments in which we live our life and build acceptance and awareness of our own emotional experiences, then we can use them to our advantage to be able to make really critical changes. It's a well-researched treatment dating back to the late 80s, early 90s, developed by a psychologist by the name of Marshall Linehan. And it was developed for people who were experiencing multiple problems related to emotion dysregulation. And what does that mean? It means that, there are people who are biologically vulnerable to experiencing their emotions really intensely. I personally believe that's an absolute gift if harnessed in the right manner. But in today's culture, experiencing your emotions intensely are tend to be judged, labeled, and even invalidated. And then you learn to cope with those intense emotions in self-destructive ways. Alcohol, drugs are certainly one of them. Self-injury, suicide, outbursts. So the environment changes based on your reactions. So a lot of people who might be struggling emotionally, they enter into these self-destructive patterns, they serve a function. And that function often leads to more long-term problems, but in the short term can help them feel better or to get their environment or change the way the people in their circle or way relationships respond to them. A great example of that is threatening suicide. Get somebody to get closer to you and express their love to you. And so then you begin to learn that I'm loved when I'm in distress. And so if I make those threats, then I feel like I am loved. Back to a previous question about the role of social media is, you know, one of the things we see is, you know, we'll see young people cutting themselves, self-injurious, and then posting that on social media and then getting this strong response back about how loved they are and you're so important to us. And so that's reinforcing that. DBT is a series of skills. It includes, you know, attending skills training to learn emotion regulation skills, which is helping yourself feel better. Distress tolerance skills, which basically means, you know, how do I make a, if I'm already in a lot of distress and I'm facing a problem, how do I not make it worse by entering into like substance abuse or cutting myself? So how do I regulate that emotion enough for me to then solve the problem? And interpersonal effectiveness skills, which is help build the skills to be able to get what you want into relationships, which a lot of people who are struggling with intense emotions are struggling to maintain relationships. And then the last major component is mindfulness, which is a form of connection to the present moment that has meditative roots and so forth from an Eastern philosophical perspective. And the overarching philosophy in DBT is that we believe our clients are skill deficit. They might have a biological vulnerability, but they also have skill deficits that they have to learn. And that we also, when working with parents from this model too, we have to get the parents to change the way they respond to their kids, because part of their reactions are maintaining the problem behaviors. So as far as some of the things, some of my favorite aspects of dialectical behavior therapy is concepts like opposite action. So being able to change your behavior in response to how you feel in order to change the way you feel. So often what happens with people who are struggling, their emotions drive them, let's say they're really anxious or they're really depressed, to isolate or to avoid. And that isolation and avoidance then intensifies their mood negatively and doesn't allow them to solve problems. So when you set things up in a very experimental way, and try to utilize skills like opposite action, like actually acting opposite of how you're feeling, then your environment, it changes the way the environment reacts to you and tends to resolve some of the problems that exist, which ultimately changes the way you feel. There's so many components of dialectical behavior therapy that are like well integrated into lifestyle. Like one of the things that I've implemented into my life recently is cold exposure. And I've learned just the dive reflex about just diving, ducking your head into really cold water. It's kind of like a non-pharmacological benzodiazepine. You know, it's just it has this way of like focusing you and altering the way you feel, decreases anxiety, engages the parasympathetic nervous system. And so I've been implementing cold baths in my life and then finishing with dunking my head in the cold water. And just what that does to changing my well-being for like upwards of 4 to 6 hours is just amazing, as we can induce these biological mechanisms to feel better. And that includes obviously exercise and the foods that we eat, that we can change the way we feel through active action. Other cool things about dialectical behavior therapy is, you know, changing the way we think. So we, there are some things in life that are just certainly outside of our control. But the one things that are in our control is how do we respond to adversity and challenges. So learning the skills to kind of check facts, think about situations differently that alters our perspective, has a profound impact on how we feel about it, which opens up opportunities then for us to behave differently. And when you develop a greater repertoire of skills, both cognitively and behaviorally, it tends to have really lasting results, because you start beginning to develop the confidence to be able to face and solve problems. And ultimately, that's what we want. We want the people who come into a center like ours, we want to see what they're feeling to be valid, and they have problems to face. And we want to be able to build their capacity to be able to overcome them, not to self-identify as disabled and avoid and not learn the skills to be able to overcome them.
Beautiful. So thank you, Roger, so much. This has been amazing. Like I said, we'll put a bunch of links to your Substack and to your newsletter and to your podcast, Radically Genuine. Is there anything, any last word you'd like to share with us and this community of people who are looking for mindset shifts for healing and health?
First, I just want to thank everybody for their attention. I know we were on this for quite some time, and so I do appreciate it. I think it has to be a large kind of grassroots effort to be able to start changing thinking around this. And one of the ways to do that is having that conversation with your personal physicians. In my experience, most physicians are really good people who just want to help, and they care about helping other people. And if there are alternatives for them to be able to consider to help you, or there's new information that they can be exposed to, those conversations are absolutely important. They are limited. And that's what I continue to get from talking to medical professionals who are both friends of mine, or those who I've just consulted with, is they feel really limited in what they're able to do based on the healthcare system, the manner in which we're providing healthcare. But those critical conversations are necessary. So I hope we can start changing the way we think about it. Correct information. When someone believes that there's an antidepressant drug or that a chemical compound can easily solve your problems, or your emotions are symptoms of illness, we can start correcting those ideas, and we can live better. I really do believe that. I think it's an awakening, and we're starting to move in the right path.
Beautiful. So call to action, my personal call to action to all of you, if this resonated with you, or if you're just curious and provoked and want to dig in more, go listen to the Radically Genuine podcast. The first 10 episodes will give you a lot of background information on the science of these medicines and sort of how Dr. McPhillan has come to the position he's at through a deep dive into the research. So thank you again. This has been amazing.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Healing Grove podcast. If you liked it, please be sure to like and subscribe. And if you want to deepen your experience further, consider grabbing a copy of the Healing Grove playbook. With journal prompts for this podcast and 41 others, it's the perfect place to record your learnings, keep track of the tools you explore, and reflect on your own experience. Finally, it's important to mention that even though I am a doctor, nothing you hear on this podcast, whether from myself or my guests, constitutes medical advice. Any intervention you try should always be discussed with and supervised by a trusted member of your own healing team. Thanks for listening, and see you next time in the Healing Grove.